Welcome to episode 129 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is March the 16th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my 132nd Irish brother, James Furlough.
Is that what we are? 132nd?
I don't actually know. It's
close enough?
I guess every year, sometimes we're a 16th, sometimes we're a 64th.
When is St. Patrick's Day, actually?
Mañana. It starts at midnight, man. That's when we get to start
tomorrow,
drinking our beers. And but we're a wee bit Irish. You can tell.
I can change my dress-up plans for tomorrow.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because,
I was planning on doing, like, this red-orange, really bright, loud shirt with a blue jacket on top.
Yeah.
Those colors are not green.
I tend to not wear green, so that somebody says, you're not wearing green, I get to pinch you. And I always say, you pinch me? I'll punch you. And they'd be like, yeah, but you're not wearing green. I'm like, yeah, but I'm still going to punch you.
I think you like green socks or something. I'll figure it out.
That's my Irish heritage coming out. I don't want to fight somebody. That's racist. It's okay. I'm a 32nd Irish. I could have also gone with my brother who was born in 5 BI.
5 BI.
Yeah. 5 years before internet, as this week was the birth of the internet.
Well, there you go.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about that as a possible descriptor, and then it occurred to me that there might actually come a day, a century from now, a millennium from now, if it lasts that long, that we will actually think about it in that context. there was the time before the internet.
I feel like it'll be more like before sentient computers.
Mm.
Would be more of the demarcation of history.
I have a feeling that we're going to keep changing the definition of sentient until there's not a clear moment that it happens.
That could also happen.
We've completely modeled the brain and as a neural network, and we are simulating with absolute precision an actual consciousness.
It's
not a consciousness. It's just a computer simulation. Fine.
Well, and I've got an article to tease that we'll talk about that seems to imply that'll never happen anyway. So.
Cool.
Well.
And then we're going to get to watch that. We get to watch that movie with John Depp, Transcendence. That's going to be pretty exciting.
I have no idea what you're talking about. And I'm serious. I have not heard of that movie.
Oh, yeah. It's one of your summer blockbusters, but. Captain Jack Sparrow gets sucked into a computer and then starts to kill people. It seems crazy. I don't know, but it's like a.
If it doesn't involve a soldier during winter, I'm not really interested right now.
You know what? I totally understand. I saw one of the greatest trailer remixes of all time. It's the scene from the trailer where Captain America is chasing the Winter Soldier through, some hallway, and all they did was overlay the music from Team America over it. America! it's not safe for work, if you're going to go check it out, but it's worth Googling. It's pretty awesome. America! Oh, man. Good times. Like normal, we're not here to talk about Irishness and movies. We're here to talk about the internet and things related to it. So this week, like every week, we will be discussing technology and the continuing corporate opera, or the soap opera of corporations dealing back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, last but not least, the technology they are developing. But before we get into the heart of the show, James has a short disclosure that he wants to throw at you so that nobody gets mad at him.
That's right. I work for HP. However, I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
Yes. So,
there you go, we're covered.
Hey, that goes for me. I don't work for HP, and I definitely don't represent any of their opinions. Although, if you guys would just listen to me, I mean, things would be awesome, because I know what I'm talking about, all right? Have you listened to this show? Obviously, I know what I'm talking about.
I'm a good employee, too, by the way. I bought some HP ink today.
Oh, nice.
Original. Bought an XL black cartridge. I don't know if I'm great, because I have an inkjet, and I let the color totally run out, and I have zero desire to refill it. So it's essentially a mono inkjet printer. But it works.
Hey, you know, that's it's you're just going old school. You're a dude. Oh my
yeah.
gosh. Oh, okay. So this is apropos of very little. I was watching Ghostbusters this Saturday morning.
Wow.
And I know it's awesome. And I had totally forgotten about the scene where when they first like are setting up shop and they got the I can't remember her name, but the chick who's their like secretary. And she's hit him on Egon.
Yeah, what is her name? I can't remember.
Janine, that's right. Yeah, Janine is hitting on Egon. She's like, do you like to read? And Egon looks at her and goes, I don't read. Print is a dead format. That's awesome. Back in the day, got like a super old computer, and I'm like, oh, that's so funny because this is like literally, awesome. This is like mid 80s, like the internet's just been invented. This is great. Oh, Egon, what a cool character.
He was ahead of his time.
Oh, yeah. Hardcore. That's such a great movie. Except I was watching it on VH1, which, if you don't like commercials, that station makes you want to blow up your TV. I mean, it was like, it was literally a minute and a half of the movie for 2 minutes of commercials. I made it
so
through.
You don't own the movie?
So that's what's stupid, is I just turned on the I, like, never just, like, sit on TV. But I was, like, eating or something, so I just turned the TV on as, like, a momentary distraction. Because I literally have the DVDs sitting right out, like, in my room. I was like, oh, I could totally watch this for, like, you know, a couple of minutes. And, yeah, after the first commercial break, I was like, well, okay, I came in at a bad time. But when I realized it was, like, the second commercial break, and it was VH1, I was like, okay, this is it. I'm not doing it. I almost...
They stretch a that's classic where they stretch a 2-hour movie into 5 hours. It just kills me.
It's awful. I almost bought them on iTunes on Friday, and I had to talk myself into like, no, Matthew, no. You own them on DVD, you don't need them quite yet. Relax. But anyways. If you want to follow us throughout the week, we're on all sorts of social media, like the Twitter and the Facebook and Instagrammable stuff, and Snapchat and whatnot. But and if you hunt me down on most of those, I'll probably friend you. But definitely, if you go to Twitter at Matthew D. Furlough, that's my handle there. Go check that out. Also. On Instagram, I'm NextWiggin4, NextWiggin, like Tigger, 4, the number 4.
I am James Furlough on Twitter and .com on the rest of the internet and on Instagram and pretty much everywhere else. Yeah, that's me.
Nice. If you want to go and check out all sorts of cool stuff regarding the show, you can go to furloughbros.com. We got the show podcast there. We got the show clips podcast, which is your little bite-sized nuggets. I had a big, long discussion this weekend with somebody who's trying to start their own podcast and about the ideal length of a podcast. And if 2 hours is a little too much for you to take, well, then we got something that's a little more ideal. And those are show cuts. Also, we got the YouTube link, so if you're listening to the podcast, you want to see the video, you can go there. If you're listening to YouTube and you want to get the podcast, you know, same portal. It's a bridge. That's what it is. It's a bridge. It's the Cinemar universe. It's a multi-dimensional up, down, 3D, 4D, through time and space. Check it out. Also, we put all of the links there for any videos that we show, any articles we talk about, stuff like that. It's just a good resource. Check it out. Tell a friend. Do it, man. We appreciate it.
So, all right, so I'm curious, what's the optimal length?
They thought it was 45 minutes.
Huh.
I was there. That's what they're researching.
You gotta get your introductions at that rate.
I was going to say, I mean, you got to hit the ground running. yeah, they
I guess if you're not brothers and you're not friends, you just get down to business.
That's the thing. They are, well, okay, so I was laughing with them because they're starting a movie blog or podcast, and they're going to talk about movies and stuff, and they are brothers. And I laughed and I said, so basically, you're going to do what we do, which is talk about movies for 45 minutes, and then the only difference is you're going to pause, or like you're going to stop the recording at that point.
yeah, really. That's a great idea, actually. We should maybe think about that as an extension.
Exactly. Dude, somebody was like, we were talking, and I was like, yeah, like honestly, our podcast is a movie review podcast disguised as a tech podcast. Some ways, it's definitely what it is. Man. You know what? I think it's time, though, to actually stop beating around the bush and start talking about it. Get into it. Okay, so you know what dropped this week?
No.
Titans. Have you been following... Have you been following the Titanfall at all?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay. Nope. I was going to say, this is going to be... Oh, jeez. You're killing me, James.
I'm sorry. It was a bad week for me, okay?
Yeah, but this has been, like, the biggest game for the Xbox One, like, coming, man. It's okay.
I don't own an Xbox One. My wife's not going to let me buy an Xbox One. So why would you
get all excited about it? Okay, I need you to do me a favor. I need you to, like...
Do you want an Xbox One?
Not yet. I will not, because I'd rather buy this game for PC, but I might buy this game for PC. It looks pretty incredible. I would go and like Google Titanfall pictures right now, maybe not whole videos and stuff, because chances are anybody who's listening to the podcast does know what it is. You're the only one.
I'm the weirdo. All right.
Yeah. But basically what the premise of this game is that you're like a foot soldier in like a super futuristic stuff, right? And you're going to be fighting in urban warfare. And so you get like this jetpack and like you're running around with your gun and you're like jumping all over the place and stuff. And then after a couple of minutes, you get reinforcements, which is a giant walking artificial tank or artificially intelligent tank that like is your guardian. So like you'll be fighting and like getting a good position, and then they drop a tank in behind you, and it's basically a giant mech warrior. And then it like you fight on the ground getting good position. Well, it like fights on the streets, and then finally at some point for reasons that they haven't disclosed yet, it'll grab you and throws you into its chest, and then you're commanding the mech from inside. It just looks awesome. I mean, it's like one of those classic, it's just a mech game, but it looks awesome. It just looks really, really well done. They got cool technology and stuff. And they think it's going to be one of the big system sellers for the Xbox One. PlayStation 4 has been kicking Microsoft. So it was like a 2-to-1 ratio in January for sales in February.
Wow.
In North America at least. In February, it felt like a 1.2-to-1 ratio. So PlayStation 4 wasn't like killing Xbox like it had been, but it was still outselling it, you know, by a decent clip. And they think that Titanfall is going to change the calculus and, for March and probably ongoing, they'll be jockeying for first and second place. It's a bit of a system seller is what people are saying.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. And it's crazy. So I love mech robots. I think they're awesome. So this is like things to my soul. War technology. So I've been doing research on this game, and there's some cool stuff going on. Number one, one of the things that they do is really interesting that I thought was interesting is that I guess the audio on the game is actually really good, and it's kind of a big deal. But they're so part of what this research that I was doing is like they were talking about like how they keep the package of the game small. Because what they really want is they want incredible audio, they want incredible graphics, and they want incredibly intelligent players and, you know, in the background.
And it's small.
And they, and they want a relatively small footprint. You're like, okay.
Of course.
That's awesome.
Of course.
So one of the things that they did was, it's common in the video game industry to not license MP3 compression technology. Some of your more traditional music codecs and stuff, especially the stuff that's hardware accelerated, because it's really expensive. And generally you're dealing with some pretty high powered hardware. And so if you're going to create these really complex, great sounds for video games, and this is something that they thought was important, so they put a lot of effort into it. They've got all these uncompressed music stuff that they're basically mixing together live, and they require like quad core processors to be able to run this game well, because like one of the cores is dedicated to mixing the sound so that it sounds good as you're playing.
Wow.
Yeah, that's all right. So it's like the download for the PC version of the game is it's like 18 gigs. I mean, it's a huge game, right? But in order But in order to be able to get it to run on like your minimum system spec requirements, so like your i5 dual core integrated graphics card, which is what I have, so it's amazing that it runs on it. They were like, basically we didn't have enough processing power to do sound. To do all the sound mixing. So we had to do all the sound mixing ahead of time. And you know, cut some corners and stuff so that there's these more complex sound systems. It becomes a 38 gig download.
What?
Yeah, it's like 20 gigs.
We're right, but we're gonna take half your hard drive.
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet.
It's like 20 gigs of audio that they have to pre-compiled. Everybody was like, they were like, that's unreal. That can't be. And they're like, well, we just sort of put all of the language packs in there, so doesn't really matter. Like, you can't select English only, and everything's pre-compiled, so there's like a lot of different languages and a lot of different versions of everything, and you know, it's crazy. Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So which version would you have to download?
That one. My computer strategy for the last half a decade has been integrated graphics cards and stuff. I want a lot of RAM, I want some good horsepower, but I'm like, whatever, who needs a graphics card? I don't do a high-end graphics processing. And for the most part, it's worked out for me because I haven't spent a tremendous amount of money on software that I'm rarely ever use, aka high-end video games and high-end video processing stuff. It's a good thing. It's a good thing that I haven't done that. But yeah, that's a compromise that makes it a little bit more difficult. But the other crazy thing that they're doing with this game is they wanted to, with the Xbox One, they found that they were kind of in this weird place of, they wanted these amazing graphics, right? They wanted to be first, you know, next gen, clearly great stuff. And, and they also wanted to be able to run on the Xbox 360 and to have, you know, parity graphics. Maybe not your full amazing, you know, a bazillion polygons and all your different effects and everything, but they still wanted it to be great. They wanted to be able to run on low-end systems. And what they're running into is this issue where they're saying, like, they felt like they had to make a choice between either really intelligent artificial intelligences, so you can have a bunch of different enemies, huge maps, you know, with all sorts of stuff going on. And most importantly, a really smart Titan that's your defender. You know, that's their big thing. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's your partner, and it's not being commanded by somebody else. It's basically a co-op game with this really smart tank that occasionally you take over. And they're like, so it was really important for them to have great AI, but that takes a tremendous amount of processing power, and it was going to distract from the graphics, and it was going to make it almost impossible to run it on lower-end systems like the 360. So they came up with this, like, interesting plan, and they worked it out with Microsoft. Microsoft has got this their big server offering right now is the Azure, I hate it when I can't pronounce things. One second. Come on. The Azure Cloud Infrastructure. Which is, yeah, I mean, like,
competing against HP and Amazon and I think Google, that stuff, yeah.
Exactly. And so the guys at Titanfall said, hey, we want to leverage your cloud infrastructure. And basically what we want to do is we want to have every round, every game of Titanfall be effectively a massive multiplayer game where six of the people on the map are controlled by players, and the rest are controlled by the servers. And so they've got these huge maps with a bunch of different enemies and stuff, and your tanks and tanks. And without an internet connection, they're not going to do anything because they're server side AI.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it allows them to, you know, build these really complex, really smart, you know, really processor intensive, artificial intelligence and have them all, you know, run in the background, basically. Not run in the background, but, you know, offload all that legwork. So really and truly, the Xbox is only rendering the graphics and rendering the music.
Which this is isn't evidently EA who's making it, is it?
No. No.
Okay, good, because otherwise it won't work.
Yeah. Well, and that's actually one of the big concerns.
I was going to say, I mean, that's a legitimate concern, right? I mean, we saw SimCity tried to do that, and that didn't work out so well.
Well, and it's, I mean, the Azure cloud infrastructure is pretty robust, and it's been kind of tested. So the launch happened this week, and what they thought was really funny was the launch happened, and everybody was like really afraid that the Azure was gonna collapse and was gonna have problems, and it was gonna make it difficult to play the game. It ended up being, it did have problems, but not in the way that they thought. In that it completely, like, there was such a rush of people getting on their Xboxes that it completely took down the login for Xbox Live for like 6 hours. People couldn't get their Xboxes to work at all. Like, oh, that's not good at Microsoft.
That's almost worse.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, it's I don't know. It's interesting. It's one of those things where this is the direction it's going. It makes sense. I mean, you know, if it were up to Google, everything would be done, you know, server side, and this is the way the technology is progressing. They're working stuff out. And really and truly, I mean, outside of, you know, a little brief Xbox Live collapsed, I haven't read anything but, you know, Titanfall's awesome. It's been battling a couple of their major titles that got released this week, so. You know, people playing Dark Souls and stuff like that have been talking about it. But, it's cool. Very cool. Definitely
that
recommend
is cool.
You watch the trailers, and there's one that I really, if you go to the article, James, it's a video of, you probably have to watch this later so you don't destroy our internet connection, but it's a video, it's like a live action one, and it's pretty cool. It'll get you really excited.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Sweet.
Titanfall.
Nice. Titan! Interesting. I'm actually going to take us a step back.
Okie dokie.
To South by Southwest, which we kind of ignored last week.
Well, yeah.
Other than making comments about people going that didn't make sense why they were going. Anyways, it happened. It's done. And, you know, the kind of the thing with it is who won? Who was the hot new startup that had breakaway success as a result of South by Southwest? You know, which, what was that, in like 2006? It was Twitter, and then 2007 it was Foursquare, and then 2008 it was something, and blah, blah, blah. And that's kind of died out a little bit. But, yeah. Because I think like last year or 2 years ago, it was supposed to be like the group messaging app. What's it going to be? And it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
And so anyways, they were talking about like this year and like, you know, what could it have been? And Quartz magazine, blog, whatever, QZ, they were like, honestly, it was television.
Hmm.
Plain old TV was what? Really what stole the show.
Yeah.
And they were just like, like it was, there were no mobile breakout app, no new hot startup, no celebrity founder holding court over the conference. But he said everyone was talking about television. Like, for example, Jimmy Kimmel, he brought his ABC talk show there for the week, and he was all over the place. Seth Meyers also showed up to promote his late show. They were even talking about, like some of the top speakers were TV show people, like Mindy Kaling from The Mindy Project or The Office, if you're that old. And I know some other people. And then what they said it was apparently even the Oculus Rift guys put together this simulation where it was some wall from Game of Thrones, which I don't watch, so I don't know what it's referring to. But apparently you could go up to the edge and look over it, and it was this immersive experience of the Game of Thrones world. They're like, again, television. And they were even saying that the pedicabs had been, some of them had been redone to promote CBS's Under the Dome. And again, you know, just over and over and over again. And then, but they said that it was, it was really evident that that was the case because while they were there, it was also the finale of True Detective, which apparently is an amazing show.
Yeah, all three episodes of it. It's doing the whole three episode thing is all of a sudden really hot. It's been working really well with the Sherlock Holmes folk. So, you know, it's like they're basically 3 2-hour episodes, if I'm not mistaken, and so they're like, it's like three movies that all tie together to this.
Yeah, I think I heard it was 8 hours total, but yeah.
Yeah.
But they were saying is like normally there were viewing parties and people were like going back to their hotel rooms to watch this instead of being out, you know, talking to people and trying a new hot startup. And it's so fascinating to me how quickly, and I think David Carr of the New York Times pointed it out. So I would agree with this. He goes, in the short span of 5 years, table talk has shifted, at least among the people he socializes with, from books and movies to television. The idiot box gained heft and intellectual credibility to the point where you seem dumb if you're not watching it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, it's kind of, you know, I know Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, that political one, House of Cards, True Detectives. You know, it's funny. I mean, like, you know, I think really and truly, if I were going to be, you know, like, and maybe people will disagree with me on this, but I think from a pop culture perspective and just sort of how people view TV, I think something really shifted when The Sopranos came out. Where it was HBO put on a show that a lot of people got HBO specifically for it, and it was as good as movies and people loved it. It was a 5-season series, and it was a relatively short run. It was a complete story arc, you know, and it was just really amazing cinema compressed into a TV show. And then, you know, and that sort of, that success gave birth to, a lot of what HBO has been doing since then, especially like in what they're doing with Game of Thrones, is really their second breakout success of just a crazy great TV show. And then Breaking Bad, I mean, it really changed, I think, like, from people I've talked to and just what I've read and stuff, Breaking Bad changed how we thought about what great TV was going to be, because it was a network TV. It was, you know, you could show it. You didn't have to buy HBO, and it was great. And I guess we talked about this before we started broadcasting, but I finally watched the last episode today. And I don't disagree, but you know, just from like, and what they showed though was that you could get fantastic directors, fantastic actors, fantastic writers, and put incredibly compelling dramas that a lot of people would rather watch instead of movies, on just network TV. And then put it onto Netflix after that and blow up huge. And it gave, you know, there's this movement that's growing, that TV is not just, you know, bubblegum stuff that you do in your free time. And I think the Netflix culture of, you know, sitting down and watching, you know, you don't have to sit down for a time slot. You don't just like, you know, tune in and, you know, plug it. It's like when you turn it on and you watch, quote, a bunch of TV, generally what you're watching is the complete long story arc of a show over the course of, you know, multiple episodes. You're quote unquote binging. But we used to binge in, you know, all the time. You sit down at the end of the day and, you know, watch a couple of TV show episodes. And I think it's just, I don't know, it's interesting. I mean, we've talked about this before, and it's just changing the nature of the art. You know, what drives me nuts about it is, and I'm not super thrilled, is that, yeah, it's great, and it takes unbelievable amounts of time. I think not having a time constraint is good to some degree, and I think a lot of, I think, you know, the most beautiful art is, in my opinion, is made with constraints. Take a creator and give them no constraints, and what they produce is Indiana Jones 4. You know, take a creator and give them a bunch of creates, and what they create is Indiana Jones, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, it's, you know, and it's just I don't know. So,
yeah,
we'll see. But yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, people that, oh, you're not watching True Detectives? Oh, jeez, what a plebeian! All right, let me guess, you're gonna go read a book?
Huh? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna read a book. Harry Potter.
That's pretty good.
Exactly. It's interesting. It's interesting that that South by Southwest was so swept up in that. It's funny, I mean, you say we didn't really pay attention to South by Southwest, but I read every single article out of South by Southwest, and I didn't think any of them were interesting. Mostly because, like, the one app that really, like, everybody was talking about was this, like, Secrets app, which is a direct competitor with Confide, which is the app that I was, like, you know, I talked about on the show after, I think it was CES. And the fact that the one that I thought was cool didn't win kind of bothers me, so I don't want to bring it up.
So, have you tried Secret?
No, I haven't.
I hear it's really sticky and well done or something.
Yeah, I should download it and just get over my pride. But
you should, man. Do it for the podcast.
Okay.
Do it for the podcast.
I will.
Report back.
Okay.
If I'm around next week, do it then. Otherwise, wait a week.
Okie dokie, artichokey. But so, do you want me to go first? I'll go first.
You go first.
Okay. So we don't talk
We're gonna talk about currency. Interesting.
I know. It's funny. I have a lot of friends that don't think there's anything more important than Bitcoin. I have a lot of friends that think Bitcoin is the greatest joke in the world, and then I have an unbelievable number of friends that don't have any idea whatsoever what's going on with Bitcoin. I mean, it was just a great disparity. You know, there's the group that gets it, and they're like either super hot or super cold. And then there's the group that doesn't get it at all, and it's a much bigger group. And obviously, there's just been a lot of drama going on in the universe of Bitcoin. That I don't know. It's at like. Mount Gox is getting, which was a secure deposit based in Japan, that's filing for bankruptcy, and a bunch of people are losing their Bitcoins, and Bitcoins are getting stolen and stuff like that, and people are starting to
It's crazy out there. It's crazy.
Yeah, you can buy your Tesla with Bitcoin. You can't buy it in New Jersey with Bitcoin. I'm having a hard time not getting off on that tangent. It bothers me so much.
Bitcoin.
So it's this whole idea of it becoming a digital currency, right? And it's a government. It doesn't require a government to exist, and it's all sort of managed through peer-to-peer network stuff. And it's a system of ledgers, is what it is, James. Which it's funny. I mean,
you know what you just said there? No.
Yeah. Well, I love it when people say that, because it's just like it super oversimplifies it. But at the same time, that's effectively what it is. Is it's this idea that there is not a central server that has a giant database of where all the coins are and who owns them, which is how a lot of people thought something like this would have to work, which would mean you'd have one server that you would need to hack, and it would require some sort of a governing body. And so the brilliance of Bitcoin is that it's this distributed network of keeping track of something, and it's secure enough that you could give it some sort of a value. Effectively, what I heard
one of the big technical hurdles was figuring out when you transfer a Bitcoin, how do you make sure the one you had disappears?
Right.
You know, because normally when you duplicate a file, that's you duplicate it. There's two versions of them, and they had to figure out how to not do that.
Right.
Which it would be interesting to see if like Amazon or iTunes or someone is watching that very carefully. You know, right. Or the movie studios, right? Yes, we'll sell you one copy, and you can give that copy to your friends, but that's what will be happening. You won't hold on to the digital version of it.
Right. Well, and part of the beauty of it is that it's this quote-unquote system of ledgers. It's you can take one of these. It's effectively what happens is in a very distributed way, there's no single ledger like you would have in a single database. There's a bunch of small ledgers, and they're all kind of duplicated, and with a history of each of the Bitcoins and where they are and who owns what. And so they're all kind of communicating and talking together. And one of the parts that is really confusing for people with Bitcoins is this whole system of mining. You're like, what are you doing when you mine? Yeah. And it's you're quote unquote solving an algorithm, but that algorithm that you're crunching is actually running numbers, and it's connected to the internet, and it's a multi-threaded thing, and that is what's keeping track of the ledgers. That is the backbone of the system. And effectively, what would have to happen is effectively what they're doing is they're paying people to act as the backbone to create this massive distribution of servers that's actually keeping track of everything through this system of mining.
What happens when all the coins have been mined?
That's a great question. And
which, by the way, you got your machine set up? Are you mining right now?
I am not mining right now because I remember how we were talking about how I don't have like really super powerful computers. It's not worth enough money to me.
I started doing, because I got interested and I was like, dude, I'm gonna mine some bitcoins. Why not? I had a laptop that I just wasn't using, so yeah. I was like, sure, why not? I'll let that sucker run in the background. I don't care. And then I started doing some more research and went, oh, this would just be a waste of time.
Yeah,
it's all right.
It's, you've got to have a lot of processing power to keep up with.
Well, because it's not like the crazy part about it is you mine, and how do I want to describe it? Like, it's almost like a lottery system.
Yeah.
And so if you don't have a strong enough computer, so the way it works, like you said, is you're solving some algorithm, and for each piece that you solve, you essentially get to put the ticket into the bucket.
Yeah.
You know, and then every so often, I can't remember it right now, they pull it out and they go, "You win a Bitcoin."
Yeah.
And so the more you can mine, the more tickets, you know, you put in, the higher percentage chance of you getting a Bitcoin. And so, you know, so, and I was just like, oh, I'll have like a fraction of a ticket in the pot. Fantastic. I mean, I could win and that would be, it'd be amazing.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah. Just, like, statistically speaking, you're like, it's not going to happen. Especially when you think about how many people you're competing against. And,
right.
And oftentimes what will happen now is like, you'll have companies where they set up a server farm, essentially. And what they'll say is they're all working together and you can buy into the server farm and say, yeah, I'm, you know, I'll pay for one of these servers. And then if that server farm wins a Bitcoin, you then split it amongst everybody. But
right.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating process. And I was like, yeah, I'm good.
Well,
I'll watch.
I think what happens, yeah, exactly. I think what happens eventually with the, when we quote run out of Bitcoins is the idea is that it'll have gained so much traction as a, you know, as a system of, you know, trading, that there will be somebody will have figured out how to make money off of being a bank. And the banks of Bitcoin will effectively run the servers that run Bitcoin. And so there won't be a central government, but it'll be consolidated into a few people that take a fraction of a percentage of, you know, whatever they're doing. And maybe it's the exchanges, and maybe that's what it becomes, is there's a couple of exchanges, and they take, you know, when you switch dollars to coins, they take, you know, 2-3%, and that's what they make all their profit off, and they're just a giant server farm, that, you know, changes money. But I think eventually that's where it goes, for, you know, the life of Bitcoin. But there is a risk at some point that the whole thing just collapses because everybody gets bored. smart guys.
They're saying one of the big issues they're running into now is that the prices are climbing up pretty substantially. So people are holding on to them because they're like, price is going up. Why would I ever spend it? Why would I cash it in? It's still going up. And so they're like, it's hard to convince people to, you know, to spend their money. Yeah, they're like, no, I was going to be worth an extra $100 in 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. So I read a really cool article this week talking about Bitcoin, and I thought it really kind of hits into the heart of what we do here. Since we talk about more than just technology and movies, we also talk about, you know, the companies behind them and economic policies and whatnot. And so Goldman Sachs finally released their big what are your thoughts on Bitcoin? Goldman Sachs is one of your, you know, probably if not the leader of world finance, one of your definitely top five. Too big to fail is one of the things that they're known for.
They're rather large.
Yeah, they are, and they're gigantic financial institutions. So when they move on these sorts of things, they take measured and cautious steps. And basically, the big headlines out of Goldman Sachs' review of Bitcoin is Bitcoin's not a currency, which goes directly across what most of the media has been saying for a while. And
what is currency? That's
exactly
the question.
Exactly. And that's what I think is fascinating. And basically what they said, and it's funny, I have a few friends that are like super hardcore into Bitcoin. You know, really, you know, this is their form of civil disobedience. They think it's going to change the world and how governments are run and whatnot. And I was talking with them. And I said, yeah, I thought this was interesting. Goldman Sachs says it's not a currency, it's a commodity. And they were like, oh, thank goodness, finally some, you know, financial institutions really acknowledging it. And I was like, why haven't you guys been calling it that for all along? And it's funny because when I try to describe what it is to people, you know, who are wondering, and I always say you can't think of Bitcoin as like you're buying a dollar bill. What you have to do is you have to think about it as I'm buying a share of a company, and we're going to trade shares. You know, if it'd be like saying I'm going to take $500 and buy, or I'm going to take $50 and buy 10% of an Apple share, and then I'm going to go to the store and I'm going to give you, you know, 1/50th of what I have, which is only 1/10th of an entire share. So that's what? It's a 200th, 2000th, whatever, of a share of Apple, and I'm going to trade that for a Twix candy bar. Is effectively how I've always described it, which is, I think, is actually kind of a, well, it's what's so weird about this is that, you know, is that it doesn't, there's nothing there. There's not, or what it represents is work that you have done in supporting the algorithm that keeps the system of ledgers. What they're saying, though, is basically like, is that Bitcoin really isn't a currency. It's more akin to gold. And there's really no reason to move off of gold as the gold standard for commodities. It's right there in the name. you know, but they said that they do think it's interesting. They think it's still going up. They think that it's not crazy to put a small amount of your financial portfolio into Bitcoin because it's still making money. And that they're, you know, but it's not a currency. And the biggest reason why they say it's not a currency is because they say it's not directly taxable. That's like one of your, that's, as far as they're concerned, that's one of the biggest definitions of what a currency is. Is it something that a government can deprive from you at the point of a gun in order to build roads? And since they can't do that with Bitcoin, since they can't tax
it. Yeah, but there are other countries that are going to be taxing it in Bitcoin. Wow. So, all right.
But they're doing it, and then the other thing that they said is that they needs a, is that currencies need a, an established exchange rate with other currencies, and since Bitcoin is a traded commodity, or is treated as a traded commodity, where it's, you know, it's what are people willing to buy it for and sell it for, and that's what determines the price of a Bitcoin, that's, it's much more akin to a, once again, to a commodity. And they said as long as there's not an established governed exchange rate, and as long as there's, it's not directly taxable by, you know, America or whoever, it can't be considered a currency in their book. But this is what I thought was really interesting. Goldman Sachs' appraisal of it is like they basically redefined what it is, or clearly defined what it is in their financial opinion. But they did go on to say that the whole technology behind Bitcoin, they think, is incredibly important. Because right now, the whole system of ledgers that we use in, you know, effectively in America for our dollars is actual dollar bills. You know, we have a physical thing. And they're basically like, what this would allow us to do is to stop printing paper. If it's a proven technology and the American government were to adopt it as a way of keeping track of all this, this technology is going to be foundational to the future of currencies. Because although it only, you know, because although it, although right now it's being used in this sort of hypothetical world of, you know, implied value with the whole, you know, with what a Bitcoin is, you know, with how they're doing it, and it's not a currency, it's a commodity. But there's absolutely no reason why that technology couldn't be used to actually track currencies. And so the long and short of what it is, what I've been telling my friends who are really into Bitcoin is, okay, I get that you're really into Bitcoin, and I'm not saying stop paying attention to Bitcoin. What I am telling you, though, is spend as much of your time as possible learning the technology of it, learning how it works, understanding exactly why it works, all of its flaws, everything that's great about it, how to make it better, and figure out how to get into companies that aren't trying to make money off of Bitcoins, but get into companies that are making money off of selling the technology of Bitcoins.
Ah, yeah, like the gold rush.
Exactly.
Don't go look for the gold. Go to the stores that are selling the tools to look for the gold.
Exactly. And because those are the guys that are going to get bought up or, you know, are going to more likely get contracted out by federal governments around the world to set up these incredibly robust and safe systems, and that's how you're going to become a billionaire.
You know, it's interesting you talk about that, and it's like there are some other companies out there doing similar things for U.S. currency. We have just started experimenting with a service called, I don't remember if we've talked about it on the podcast, called Dwolla.
We haven't, but I know of it.
D-W-O-L-L-A. It sounds like a complete joke of a company. And we're starting to experiment with it for collecting rent. And so it's, you know, instead of getting cash or a check, it's, you know, it's all digital. I send them an email, say, hey, you owe me money. And then they
give me my back.
And it's actually, it's really cool because the second they pay, I get an alert on my phone, which then alerts my wrist, and I know. And but it's this idea of it's transferring currency back and forth. It does it all digitally. It's like a credit card in that regard. It's kind of, and so in that sense, it's very similar to Bitcoin, but it just has it with U.S. money instead.
Yeah.
But, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I
know. No, I agree. The technology behind it is pretty cool. Unfortunately, the founder's deciding to stay a little hidden, so we can't pick his brain and say, hey, can you help us with some bigger problems here?
Yeah, which, you know, for better or worse, since, I don't know.
It's worse.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
But, interesting, though, Bitcoin.
Just be clear, it's worse.
I never got your opinion. What do you think of Bitcoin?
I like to take measured responses to everything. I'm not invested in it. I'm not spending any money on it because, as far as I'm concerned, I think, there's too much power in money, and I think if it ever got to the point where it was truly disruptive, it would dramatically shift in its nature. And ultimately, I mean, I guess this just goes to my, you know, to my opinion of, you know, governments and human nature and whatnot. And I think that, you know, money is so tied to, like, you know, to power that you'd expect the whole goal of the Bitcoin movement is to be truly disruptive, to, you know, make democracy not require a government, to make currency not require governments, which is a part of me that thinks it's really cool, but if that were actually possible, I think a government would, you know, people with guns would step in and say, I don't feel that. Because this is how we buy our guns, so... And not to mention the fact that, you know, you do need to build roads and you do need, you know, national defense and you do need, you know, a lot. I mean, there's a point to governments. So I think it's a complicated thing. I think the future of it is going to be really interesting. And like I said, I think I think if it were me, and I would get into, and I was so inclined to be really curious about it, I would be like only concerned about replicating it and making it impenetrable on the, you know, for the express purpose of selling it to governments so governments can stop printing dollar bills and you can turn it into some sort of a, you know,
I feel like it's really already closely there. I guess I don't fully understand the difference.
Well, I think
I buy stuff online, it doesn't require any, I don't carry cash with me. I mean, that's pretty much already my life.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just, it's, yeah, I guess. I don't know. I think to me, you know, like you said, I mean, I think the reality of it is that's the direction everything's going. Everything is digital and you know, it's numbers on the computer screen. But it's just a more robust way of, you know, making sure that people, you know, because one of the, like you said, how do you make sure that things don't get added? How do you make sure that a file gets deleted? How do you make sure that this all is kept track of in a fair and, you know, reasonable way? And I think one of the big concerns that everybody has is, you know, how do you make sure that dollar bills, you know, in the digital age don't, it's not just a matter of copy and paste in order to create a, you know, a forged dollar bill. How do you actually keep track of that? How do you make sure that this all works well? And if their system is without a government, without a massive overbody, you know, overseen body, it's just a very robust, and what I think, when it's funny, when I use the word algorithm, I mean it in the traditional sense, where it is an algorithm apart from the computers that are running it. It is a system by which, as long as it's done dedicated, as long as it's done the way it's supposed to be done, it doesn't matter if it's done on computers or by hand or whatever. It is a system by which you can keep track of non-physical items in a way that will make sure that nothing gets duplicated and everything that's supposed to get deleted does. And that, I think, is what's interesting about it. And I do think that there's a realm of computer science that will turn into a realm of computer engineering. And you know, once again, computational science in the traditional sense, apart from the silicon that's running it, in how do we compute these things in a robust way? And that's what they're doing, and they're doing it in a way that, because right now, effectively, by and large, you know, we largely just trust the banks. We largely just trust Visa. Visa makes so much money, they've got no reason to counterfeit dollars. But if they decided to, like, how would you stop them? And true. Which is a huge question. I mean, especially, you know, in America, it's not as big of a deal because we trust Visa. But your Venezuela, like, who knows?
Well, I think the big concern is not necessarily the transferring part of things. You know, the big concern is the fact that the U.S. is monetarily sovereign, and they can legally print money.
Right.
And they do legally print a lot of money. And the concern, you know, whether it's founded or not, we'll know, maybe, probably never, you know, is that out of control, and is it too much, and will the U.S. currency eventually become destabilized and lose all of its value? Because it's not tied to gold or any other standard. It's tied to you and me believing in it, that when I say this dollar bill is worth a cheeseburger on the McDonald's dollar menu, you go, yeah, I agree. Or at least McDonald's saying, yeah, I agree. I will take that piece of paper and give you a burger.
I disagree, by the way.
That's fine. But the point being that, you know, we all agree on enough of that on those things that's the value of it.
Right.
And again, the concern is with the U.S. doing its debt thing, printing off bills, could it become, destabilized, runaway inflation, that kind of stuff. To which, without getting too deep into the political side of it, I would just say is complicated. There is no simple answer, and if someone gives you a simple answer, they don't know what they're talking about. And if you think the answer is simple, you don't know what you're talking about. And so I'll just put it out there. but there's, you know, there's concerns there. And so the idea about something like Bitcoin, you know, the attraction to it is, oh, here's this other thing that its value is not stored in gold or some other external value. It's also internal. The value is just the value that we assign to it. Yeah. And the nice part about it is that there isn't some third-party single entity that can just create more of them. You know, like we've talked about, there's kind of a fixed set, and it's all decentralized, and then it's done. And, you know, so I think for a lot of people, it's got, you know, that has that. And there's others who, you know, they legitimately realize that if they invest in the machines and start mining, they can actually make some money, and, you know, so that's got value to them. But
I mean, once again,
part of the interest behind it, it's not necessarily, I mean, the technology's cool, and I think is will be useful in many ways, which is why I'm kind of like it's a shame that whoever created it is deciding to stay anonymous, unless they're, you know, not so anonymously working on something else. You know, that's you know, cool, and which they probably are. But the real, like, I think that's part of the driving force is this desire to get something else that isn't controlled by a third party. And that's hard to do. You know, that's the only example of a decentralized, we'll call it a currency.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's I think what's interesting about it is that it's not a company like Apple where, you know, Apple's not a commodity. It's a company. It plays by different market rules because of it. Whereas, you know, as opposed to gold, and it's the reason why, you know, I'll be totally honest. I'm a little bit over my head when it comes to, like, you know, real financial like policy and stuff. I like to pretend like I can hang with it. Oh yeah, I totally get what you're saying. But you know, I agree. I think that this is really fascinating in that it's, you know, they've effectively manufactured a fixed quantity, a limited resource of, you know, of a new commodity, and it's, you know, it's gold, and you know, it's, and gold is a decent example in that what's the value of gold? Well, not much. I mean, it's, you know, outside of, you know, tipping the ends of your music cords so that they have good sound quality. But that's not where most of gold's value is. It's not a limited resource that we're using. It's not like oil that, you know, we're going to run out of it because we're using it. Gold just kind of exists. And just similar to what Bitcoin is, it just kind of exists. There's a little more supply coming in constantly as they mine it, and there's a little bit coming out of supply as we use it for stuff. But for the most part, it just is. And, yeah. You know, and as a supply, and we just kind of, you know, yeah.
Well, that's the weird part, like you talked about. You know, what would be really interesting with Bitcoin and to see where it goes, which you can't do this with gold, which is why it doesn't work and which is why they're defining it as a commodity, is, you know, today, let's say that you have some money and you say, hey, I'm going to take it to the bank, put it in a deposit, and they go, cool, we'll give you, you know, half of a quarter of a percent return. And yeah. But you earn interest, essentially.
Yeah.
And when that interest happens, money is created.
Yeah.
Out of thin air. Money that did not exist now exists. It's crazy. And even I have to, like...
Oh, yeah. The money supply thing to me...
Take a little while and go, like, okay, let me think about this. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And that right now does not exist for Bitcoin, and that's where it would make an interesting twist and turn where now all of a sudden you're making money not because you mined it, but because you lent it out and... earn interest off of it.
Right.
And, you know, and so that's where it gets really interesting and probably more likely why they're calling it a commodity, because they're like, that you can't do that, at least not that, because there's no, you know what I mean? They're like,
yeah.
You're not going to come along and be like, oh yeah, I'll loan you this Bitcoin and you will then owe me more Bitcoin and therefore there's more Bitcoin. And it's like, no, right. It just doesn't work that way. I mean, yes, I guess you could say that, but the system works differently.
Yeah, well, and that's what's so crazy about it is the whole, oh my gosh, you showed me that video, which I think is overly alarmist, but just that I never really thought I had never really been like, oh yeah, that's, I knew that banks take your money and they can lend. They only have to keep like 10% of what they're lending out, right? Which means that if you give them $100, they effectively can loan out $1,000. And then when people pay at an interest rate, when people pay back more than they borrowed, that's where they take that extra money and they cut a piece of that out and they give that to you, the interest for giving them the money. And effectively, where did that money come from? I don't know. It's all in ledgers somewhere. And they, you know, their argument is that their argument was
that system of ledgers.
Exactly. Was that there's this, you know, that's the vast, you know, explosion of the money supply. The money supply is orders of magnitudes bigger than what the, you know, Fed has ever printed off because of that. And you're just like...
Well, and see, that's the interesting part is there is no money supply of Bitcoin.
Exactly.
Right. It's not. It just the Bitcoin is, and that's what will be interesting is where, again, and maybe we're generating an idea live on the air, but I'm sure someone's already thought of it, so it's not like we're that novel. But to create a bank of Bitcoin and then hand out like a Bitcoin, the equivalent of a Bitcoin credit card.
Yeah.
And that's where you go, oh yeah, and here's the digital version of a Bitcoin check. And it's you create this system on top of it, and that's the moment where you start creating Bitcoins out of thin air. And yeah, there's a set number of them, but now all of a sudden you're playing this true, you know, it becomes a house of cards, which is, again, legitimately what the U.S. is struggling with right now.
I know, yeah.
And where you're just like, you go, man, I really hope no one asks to get all the money at once, because if they do, we're in trouble, which is exactly what happened in the Great Depression. And, you know, you have these run on the banks, and they're like, yeah, about that. We don't actually have all of your money. Right. And that's the whole point of the FDIC insurance thing where they go, yeah, you know what, the banks don't have it, but don't worry. You know, big central over here, they got us covered. You know, you get your money out.
And that was, not to get, you know, too far into the weeds, but that was too big to fail, was that these banks – effectively, if they decided to pull all their money out, which is what Lehman Brothers did, and all of a sudden they didn't have any money, and people were pulling their money out, and they were pulling their money out, and everybody was pulling, and Lehman Brothers is like, guys, wait a second. This is all make-believe. You know, and Goldman Sachs bought them, and, you know, and then effectively the federal government was just like, okay, we're going to write so much money to existence out of nowhere that we can cover all your debts. Don't worry about it. So just keep pretending. It was just, you know, and it, effectively the reason they were too big to fail is because if they ran on the banks, there was no protection. Effectively what the bailout was, wow, was an FDIC protection for them. Which is just craziness. I mean, it's just craziness. Oh, Jesus.
I just want to stir the pot just a little bit to let people know that it's complicated. I want to finish it off, you know, because we've teased it enough. Our federal deficit is huge. It's grown by several hundreds of percentages in the last many years, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Which is the concern. If you look at the average growth rate of the federal deficit over time, the average growth rate of it it's close to over 100%. If you look at the average inflation rate over time, it's under 4%. So I would argue there's no real correlation to the federal deficit and inflation. Just going to put that one out there. You may think that that's true. Has never happened. So that's part of my – it's complicated.
Yeah.
Which I think the answer is because this actually will tie into tech stuff is the reason why is that we continually have new things to buy. Our money does actually if our basket of goods, the things that we could buy, stayed the same, prices would skyrocket, no doubt about it. But now we're not just buying gas and food, we also have an iPhone. Yeah. Or I should say, we no longer have just we bought cell phones. And then we bought cell phones with texting plans. And then we bought cell phones with texting plans and data plans. And so we are actually, in some way, we are spending more money, but we're spending it on a bigger, diverse set of goods.
Yeah.
And therefore, the gas price, mm-hmm. the price of gas, even though it's started to raise again, which is frustrating, but you know it is what it is. That's why the price of some things have stayed at that 3.5% growth rate, because it's just we now have a ever widening expanse of stuff, and the big concern. Which is why the whole, in my opinion, the some of the pushback on, you know, healthcare and taxes and all that stuff is if companies stop innovating and that basket of what you could buy is stagnant for too long, okay, now we might have a problem.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of data to back that up. That is hypothesis of James Furlough there.
So one of the most interesting ideas, I think, is the debate of, you know, of wealth. What is wealth and where does it, you know, where does it come from and how is it created? And I think people that have the perspective that wealth is the amount of money that's out there and that there's a collective wealth and you extract from it based on what you get a certain amount of dollars for what you do and you're extracting on this national wealth is an incomplete view of it. Really and truly, through innovation, you are generating new wealth that can
yes.
be gathered and can be spread. And that is what, like you said, that's what allows us to do all this stuff is this ever growing, you know, it's like fascinating when you look at like how big houses have gotten over the last couple of years. Like we spend, you know, the average price of houses have gone up, but the size of house and the amount of land that we have just exploded past the cost of housing. So even though housing's more expensive, you get an order of magnitude more house per dollar.
Actually, that's the price of house. The price of housing is actually very, very, very. I mean, it's like scarily correlated to square footage. And so the reason why housing costs have, and California's probably an outlier if we're honest. The reason why housing prices have risen so much and outpaced wage increases is because the size of the house has been increasing. But price per square foot, very constant. It follows very closely to wage increases.
Right. But, you know, I think, I don't know. It's fascinating.
Yeah, Bitcoin, man. Got me down the finance path. That is an
It's exciting because it's, I mean, if, and I mean, like, okay.
Well, it challenges the status quo, and it makes you think about that kind of stuff. And I think that in itself is also valuable. And you
right.
go, well, what is the value of the U.S. dollar? What is the value of Bitcoin?
Right.
Those are great questions to ask.
What really excites me is that, you know, my big thing is I'm all about automation. I like automation, and I watched this amazing video of the Amazon factories and how, like, or not factories, their warehouses and how they do that. They get these, like, cool little robots that, like, drive around all over the place, and they pick up shelves, and they drive the shelves to the people that are packaging. And effectively, it's like they've got this giant warehouse with all sorts of stuff, and they've got, like, one person that all they're doing is putting stuff in a box, taping it up, and moving it. And they got these robots running around grabbing stuff from everywhere. It's incredibly awesome to watch. And you realize that was a job that 30 years ago would have required 50 people, and there's two people in the warehouse. And that's a problem for our current economic system. It, at some point, you can automate, and it's, and Bill Gates talks about
that's
it.
That's fine.
Well, you know, and yeah, I know. It's like, but it's like, you know, we think of ourselves as sit down behind a desk and do work economy, by and large, in America. We're not a manufacturing economy, and those things can be automated with software relatively easily, and they are being, and we're putting people out of work, and at the manufacturing side of it, the robots are getting smarter, and the sensors are getting cheaper, and everything we need to do in order to completely, you know, it's the sapphire glass, you know, stuff factory in Amazon. It's the, or in Arizona for Google, right? Apple. Wow. It's the Tesla factory, which is, you know, I work right next to it. I have a bunch of friends that used to work at the NUMMI factory back when Toyota owned it and it, before it got bought by Tesla, and it employed thousands of people. And if you look at Tesla, and it's the factory's running full bore, but only a fraction of the parking lot's full because it's so highly automated now, they don't hire as many people. And it's just like at some point, you get to the point where robots are building robots and software is being written by a small, you know, the manufacturing and the production and the innovation of the nation can be done by a small handful of people. And at that point, what is everybody else supposed to do? like at some point this becomes, you know, an actual, like, economic crisis in that it's too easy to produce things. It's too easy to make food. Food's too plentiful. I know, you say nah, but I think, I don't know, I think maybe not in the next 10 years, probably not, maybe not in the next 50 years, but I think in 100 years, you know, as long as there's not a massive world war and Russia, we're looking at you. You know, I think at some point it's I know you're saying nah, like it's not a big
thing, I have reasons to.
Well, okay. Do you want to get into it or?
Yeah, I do. I was letting you continue on. You know, okay. Dig your hole. No, the thing is, I mean, that was what people predicted with the cotton gin. You know? Oh no! This is gonna put farmers out of work. And what happened? They what? I mean, that's the classic one. And sure, there were some people who were out of work and, you know, you have that structural unemployment and it happens. And, but over time, they found other stuff to do. They moved into the cities. They started innovating in new and interesting places. They invented, like, say, cars. And then, you know, is one example of something that came out of the fact that the cotton gin was invented, so people were in the cities and they needed ways to get around the cities. And so some, you know, really smart guy said, I think I can figure out a way to make these cheap. And so that was invented.
I'm not – I guess what my question is – well, you know, let me – I'm going to let you finish the idea.
Well,
we've
okay.
had this conversation. So, I want our listeners to know.
Yeah, and so – and I would say, you know, the cotton gin was one where, you know, for the most part, the United States was an agrarian economy when that happened. They did, like, one primary thing, and that was farm. And there right. were a couple things that surrounded it. Once the cotton gin came out, then it became – I don't know the exact numbers, but 100 things. You know,
right.
and now in certain places, and you know, and not, and they're all at different levels. Some of them became automated or more efficient, or whatever you want to think about, and some didn't. You know, eventually we got to like car manufacturing required a lot of people in order to do it, and over time it has become more and more automated, and so now those people, yes, there is some unemployment as a result of it, but there are those people over time. Learn how to do something different. And that, you know, those manufacturing jobs explode into something different. And the point that I'm getting at is as more and more things become automated, yes, there will be some unemployment and some people who got out of school to study that right in time to find out that it's no longer valuable. I get it. There's no easy way to solve that. But there will be people who go, hey, you know what? I'm sitting around. I'm not doing anything. I was going to be working this, you know, this software engineering job over here, but that's no longer an option. But they're smart. They're interesting. They observe the world, and they go, you know what? I saw something over here now that since I got to put food on the table, I'm going to look in this direction. And my guess, just because we've seen it, is, you know, now all of a sudden, it's not just enough to be building a website. Now you have to build an app for your business, and not just an iPhone app. You got to build an Android app, an iPad app, you know, different apps. And I guarantee you, and that's why this next article is going to be awesome, that something's going to come down the pipe where you're like, hey, you know what? All the apps are all automated. It's all good. But now we're doing these 10, 20 other things and ways to connect with businesses. You know, it used to be, oh, you run a television commercial. We're good. Now it's, you know what, you got to have a television, you know, we talked about two weeks ago, you know, about Samsung where, yeah, they ran commercials, but they also did a Twitter campaign. They were working with celebrities. That required more people in order to do it. And part of the reason why they could afford to do that was because, like, yeah, you know what, we know how to make television or TV ads. That part's automated for us already. You know, there are pieces of it that were automated. Now, yes, there are sections, you know, think about the Tesla factory. Yeah, there's going to be less people. There's probably more of a different type of person, employee working for them now. Mm-hmm. And they may eventually figure out how to automate that part. You know, I wouldn't be surprised, or at least become significantly more efficient at that piece of it. In which case, yeah, they'll have less people doing that specific task. But trust me when I say it'll be replaced by, you know, 5 to 10 other important tasks. Because you know that the Tesla cars are not going to get simplified. They're going to keep adding more and more pieces to it. And they're going to, you know, figure out ways, different ways to charge them and to track them and to keep people safe. And, you know, and that requires more people. So the umbrella just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And that's why I don't think you'll ever see the Jetson future of, oh yeah, just sit around and press the button for an hour a day and you're good to go. I don't see that happening. That's good news.
I think you're wrong. No, I agree. I would say I
think you're full of it.
Yeah. I think
you're delusional. Pie in the sky.
There's a part of me that thinks there's a part of me that agrees with you, and there's a part of me that it's funny. I read an interesting article that I didn't link, so I'll only talk about it briefly. That talked about why do we hate Google Glass and other new technologies, and they said part of the reason is because we're not imaginative enough. We can't see why this would be important. Why did everybody hate the iPad when it first came out? Why was everybody naysayers? Because all they saw was a blank canvas, and they didn't understand that you need to fill it for it to have any value. and Google Glass is the same way. And I actually think is a compelling reason why to think that it's a big deal. Is part of the fact that it's, you know, some people understand why it's such a big deal, and there are naysayers. I don't think there's ever been a really truly great idea without any naysayers. If there are no naysayers, it's too iterative. It's not a next big thing. And I say that, and basically what their complaint was is that people don't have enough imagination. That's part of the reason. Why do we need that? They don't understand yet why we need that. And that's, you know, that goes to your point of,
yeah,
you know, and maybe I like to think of myself as an imaginative, forward-thinking person, and sometimes I'm just like, maybe. To me, I'm like, thanks. And I get to the point where it's like, you know, I can see a future where everything's so highly automated that it's like, a lot of people don't need to do anything, and I guess your point is, well, then obviously not let them starve, but let them starve a little, you know, let them be hungry, let them require to do something, and then they will do something, they will find something to do.
Yeah.
And ever increasing levels of innovation, and you know, I don't know. I think it's going to be really fascinating. That's the one thing that I can guarantee is that this is going to be crazy. Because the one thing I can say is this: I doubt the way that it works currently is the way it's always going to work. And
what does that mean?
I think at some point. You know, the whole idea of it.
I guess that's what I care about.
I guess our economic system and just our system of production, right. And whatnot. And
yeah, we're still on the Bitcoin story, aren't we? Yeah, and, okay. All right, keep going.
And I think that you get – I think one of the things that the whole idea of a guaranteed minimum income, you know, right now is a big, you know, big topic of conversation. And, yeah. You know, whether or not you agree with that right now or not is, you know, that's whatever. They're, you can be for and against it. But I think at some point it becomes like, it's so easy to produce and it's so relatively free. You just get to the point where you're like, why not? You know, like, why do we let anybody starve ever? Come on now. and I think everything that I read, I don't know. I think at some point it becomes a question of, you know, communism doesn't work because people are greedy. But if there's such a gigantic supply of basic needs, everybody can be greedy. A little bit greedy, I don't know. Which I think is an interesting idea. And at the same time, I think I agree with you that just the nature of, you know, human motivation and, you know, and positive versus negative reinforcement of, you know, and stimulus and consequences, that it will limit some innovation if there's a, you know, a minimum, a guaranteed minimum income of your basic needs are fulfilled, for sure.
But it's a question of how much and to what extent, and it may not be very much at all. It may be more than we think, and we don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just cool. It's cool to think about. And it's not today. I guarantee you that. It's not today. If you think we produce enough today to be able to do that, I think you're fooling yourself. But Just it's a numbers game. It's an engineering game. It's just not there yet, but I think it could be one day and shockingly soon. But you said you had a cool, interesting article that kind of
teased and exactly. The time has come. There was this article in the New York Times. It's kind of in their magazine section, I guess. So a longer piece, and I'll try to see if I can sum it up pretty well. But it says Silicon Valley's youth problem.
Yeah. Okay?
And it says in startup land, the young barely talk to the old, and vice versa. That makes for a lot of cool apps, but great technology, not so much. And it has this picture, an older dude carrying a laptop, wearing a watch, you know, dressed up. And he goes, when will you make something that matters? Talking to a young dude, you know, wearing skinny jeans, it looks like, with a sweatshirt, hoodie, holding an iPhone, says, when will you make something cool? And and it just talks about how there's this problem. They specifically dive into a company that makes routers that got bought by Cisco, where they were, you know, they came across as cool and easy to set up, and then they got bought by Cisco, and they're like, yeah, we're dealing with that. which is interesting. But they were saying that, you know, that these dynamics are playing out throughout Silicon Valley. They were saying, like, so Intel posted disappointing earnings, and companies like Snapchat are turning down billion-dollar offers. And, you know, so they're saying, you know, Intel builds technology, and they're slowly dying, and they're not attracting new young folks, whereas you get someone like Snapchat or Facebook that and they include Google in this, and I'm like, I don't know about that. But, you know, Google, where they talk about how they are leading the consumerification of technology. And so what they're saying is that there's this rift now between old and new, between hardware and software, between enterprise companies that sell to other businesses and consumer companies that sell directly to the masses. And they go, that always seems to, you know, be the case where, you know, the new are eating out the old chewing up, whatever, I don't know. But anyways, they were saying, like, yeah, it's the normal churn of things. They're like, but this churn feels a little bit more problematic than before. And so they're saying, essentially, and we've talked about this a little bit before, in pursuing the latest and coolest, young engineers ignore opportunities in less sexy areas of tech like semiconductors, data storage, and networking, the products that form the very foundation of which all of Web 2.0 rests. You know, and so, again, coming back to these guys' thing, they're like, without a good router to provide reliable Wi-Fi, like your Dropbox file sharing application is not going to sync. Without NVIDIA's graphics producing unit, you're not going to be able to play Titanfall, right? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
You know, or in their example, your BuzzFeed gift is not going to make anyone laugh. That's a dumb example. And then what they're saying is that there's a lot of...
It's not going to make me laugh anyways.
Yeah. I don't know. It depends. I mean, it is BuzzFeed. They're pretty good at that kind of stuff.
I've already seen the GIF on Reddit 3 weeks ago, okay?
Oh, okay. All right. Well, whatever. You know, your Reddit GIF isn't going to work.
Yeah, I got it.
Which I would argue you don't need an NVIDIA graphics processing unit, but that's okay. They're saying, you know, there's a lot of talent, and a lot of it is going to Silicon Valley. But those people don't care about improving the infrastructural elements. They care about coming up with web apps because that's what gets rewarded right now. And they're just saying that this could become a problem, right? Which I'm like, maybe. I think right now we're at a stage where these things are good enough. But what's interesting is, yeah, sure, they're good enough, but they could be better. We all know it, and unfortunately, though, they're saying, like, yeah, some of the smart guys, they're they'd rather work on the on top of the stack instead of improving the stack itself. And, you know, they say, you know, part of it is, you know, if you're, you know, people go, oh, you know, who do you work for? And you say Pinterest, they all know exactly what that means. But if they're like, these guys' company is Meraki, you know, they're like, I've, what is that? You know, like, eh, we make routers. It's exciting. and I mean, even just the way I said that, like, that's the issue that we fight against, that we're not cool. And that we're not, you know, flashy, and therefore we're not attracting people and we're not attracting money. And yeah, sure, today it might be fine. And we can keep going along, but it might mean that we're missing out on making these leaps and bounds and improvements that enable the next generation of whatever that is, you know, whatever's beyond apps. And just because, oh, the infrastructure can't handle it, it's all good. And other than you might think that, you know, like with these video games, they keep making video games that keep pressing the envelope, which means the hardware guys are like, huh, we'd rather them not press our envelope, let's make better hardware. Yeah. And, you know, but the issue becomes where, great, the hardware guys want to do that, but they're just, they're not as smart, not as capable, because all the smart ones are the ones pushing the envelope.
I regularly cause white-haired old men to panic when they ask me what I want to do in 5 years, because I sit there and I go, I think it'd be fun to work for Google or Apple, and they're like, wait a second, wrong answer. You know, I don't normally give my, you know, give a disclosure, and I'd say we'll probably talk about what I do on the show like once every 20 weeks, but you know, I work, you know, what I do is I build semiconductor manufacturing equipment. I design it and build it and work with it. And these gigantic tools that are directly, we know our tools dope the silicon is what we do. And what we're primarily used for is making diodes that are used in power systems like your charging block for your laptop. And literally everybody who's listening to this podcast owns something that was made on one of my tools. Just the nature of who we've done business with, how many tools we have out there, and not necessarily a tool that I made, but the company that I work for made. And yeah, and it's, you know, we are the only furnace manufacturer for Lite-On of China, and Lite-On of China is the biggest power.
You said Lite-On?
Lite-On, yeah. If you own a Lite-On piece of equipment, if it says Lite-On on it, it's got components that have been made on our tools. And
interesting.
And there's an incredibly
remember
good
that mobile print accessory I was talking about?
Yes.
You get a piece of that credit, man.
Oh baby, you're welcome. I do foundational technologies, and that's the thing. What they really want me to do, and to fill out that idea, Lite-On is builds components, not just complete things, and they sell the components all over the world, and we got stuff all over the place. So there are components everywhere that have been made on our machines. And it's funny when I describe it like that to people, people are like, wow, that's actually really cool. I'm like, I know, right? Come on now. And the thing is that well, I said, you know, I make fun of the thing of, you know, old white men, but it's like you go to the semicon shows and they hire all these like pretty women to like, you know, stand and try to get people's attention, and they love it when we like my company walks by, because we're three young guys all in our mid-20s that actually do this, and we're super rare in the industry. We stick out like sore thumbs. They make fun of us. They're like, oh, a bunch of interns over here. Like, dude, we're all managers at our company. Like, what the heck is wrong with you people? We're like, we are the next generation. You're not supposed to make fun of us. You're supposed to, like, pamper us because we are the next generation. We're the reason why this keeps working. And they want us desperately to, like, I've had quite a few people have long conversations with me talking, you know, we want you to get into engineering, doing process engineering for actual wafer manufacturing, because it's pretty much only old guys at this point, and there aren't any young people coming through, and they're asking the question, what does our company do in 15 years when all of these guys are retired? Nobody's coming through and learning the techniques. Nobody knows how to do it, and we need an army of engineers to be able to do this, and there aren't anybody. The reality of it is, I'm going to be totally honest, it's going to sound really brutal. We can learn how to do it. And when you need us desperately enough, you'll pay us enough. Mm-hmm. And we'll learn how to do it, and we'll innovate. And it'll happen. I mean, and it's, you know, I think it's interesting, and I think it's cool, and I like doing it. But the reality of it is, and the reason why I want to work for a company like Google and Apple is because I want to build robots, and that sounds fun and cool. And they need robots right now, and I want to do that kind of manufacturing. But I sit there and I go, this is not one of those things where it's going to become, you know, I think there's a part of it is you need to let the old guard get depleted enough where there's some real financial motivation to get the new guard in. And they're going to come in and ask the question, why do we do this way? And the old guys are going to say, because we've always done it that way. And the new guys are going to say, well, we're the majority now, so we're going to do it our way. And all of a sudden you're going to see another explosion of once again, it's like just you know, And Intel does amazing work, what they do in their foundries. Like, it's incredible. It's top of the line. But they're a small fraction of silicon manufacturing in the world. And their technology distributes very slowly. They want to keep it all in-house so that it's, you know, well-protected, their little fiefdom. And that's a problem. And the thing is that, you know, those patents are going to run out, and they're going to get – China's going to say, hey, this is really cool. We want to do that. And they're going to do it for a fraction of the price. And, you know, and I don't know. I just, it's one of those things where I'm in the middle of it, and I read the article, and it just came across as a bunch of old guys complaining how the new guys don't want to get serious. Like, this is serious business, guys. And it's, you know, and I remember.
I guess I'm an old guy.
Yeah. And I remember when I was, you know, when I was young. you're very old. Dude, you were born 5 BI, okay?
That's right.
I was only born 2 BI,
I actually remember it. How about that?
That's crazy. I don't remember it. By the time I was old enough,
before we had a modem. I remember when we got our.
I do remember when we got our modem because that was in the early 90s, and I was old enough for that. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm underplaying how important this is. But I just remember when and Lockheed Martin, you know, one of our major defense contractors, they're going through this right now. They had this massive glut of old engineers who, and their problem was they were like the least exciting of the stuff because they were right in the center of the Silicon Valley as the Silicon Valley was becoming the Silicon Valley, and the smartest and brightest were building power diodes and transistors and computer chips. They're like, hey, y'all want to, you know, work for us instead? Like, no, we want to do something cool. You know, it's like you think about like how Steve Jobs talked Scully into becoming the CEO. You know, he made the classic line of, do you want to keep selling sugar water for the rest of your life, or do you want to come change the world? He got him on the want to do something cool. You know, I think these people forget that back in the day, man, it was cool to be in Silicon. And that's what's so frustrating, I think, for the old guard of computer technology, is that when they were doing it, it was cool. What they were doing was incredibly cool. And it was the cutting edge, and it was, you know, the forefront of it. And they're sitting there going, you're not doing anything cool. Not only did what we did was cool, but it mattered. Like, and it still matters. Why don't you think this is cool? I don't know. It's an interesting dynamic I think they've set up, especially in the Valley, because there's just such a conflict of, you know, the old guard and the new guard. And companies, you know, like you said, you know, Google doesn't hire old people because you're old. You don't think like us. And the old companies can't hire the young guys even if they wanted to, and I don't think they do. You know, this case, I think the New York Times had to go out of their way to find a case that really fit the narrative that they're trying to write about, where you get to see that conflict up and close, where a bunch of old guys bought a bunch of young guys. because it just doesn't happen that often. I think in the next 15 years you'll see a dramatic shift in where the engineers go, and what they do, and it will move back towards the more foundational technologies and actually building really high power chips and building routers and fiber optics technology, because it will need to. and there will be money there again, and it will seem cool as the innovators start moving in that direction again. And the other thing to say is that it's incredibly hard to innovate in that field in really dramatic ways, because there are a lot of really, really, really ridiculously smart guys that spent a lot of time making it as amazing as possible.
That's true.
They've done a pretty great job.
True.
And so they're getting down to molecular LEDs. How do you innovate past that? I think there's ways to. I think we will. But I think things like graphene and new materials will really open up the field again. We have to reimagine how we manufacture stuff. That'll change things.
All right.
It's cool.
Cool beans.
I know, right?
I'm only going to give you one more, though.
Okay.
We ended up having a good conversation.
I know, which is awesome. Okay.
What's the point?
So we could talk about industrial robots playing ping pongs with human beings, but that was clearly just a publicity stunt. Though a cool video, go check it out online. I think you should link to that, James. And we could talk about making better music with Pono, but don't go and buy one, by the way. It's a bad idea. I'm not going to tell you why. Pono, it's a music player made by Neil Young, and it's just not that awesome. But what I want to talk about... Yeah, I know. It's a big net... It's a Kickstarter campaign, but it gets really into audio processing, why it matters or not. And basically, I've got an article that says it's in these people's head. It doesn't actually sound any better. And I can prove it scientifically. And he does. But once again, what I really want to talk about is Tango. Do you remember Johnny Lee doing the demonstration at TED? One of the TED Talks where he took the Wii sensor bar. He like installed it on a pair of glasses, and then he like, he moves his head around and the graphics shift and it's all 3D-ish.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it was really awesome. If you've never seen that video, just Google it. Johnny Lee, TED Talk, Wii sensor bar. It's amazing.
Works for Microsoft, or it did, right?
Yeah. Did until Google offered him a whole lot more money, and now he works for the Google Advanced Research Labs, doing similar work. And so basically, he's the head guy on a project called Project Tango.
I want to be his friend.
I've decided this week I'm going to make a goal of mine to hang out with this guy and take him out to coffee or something, interview him. I don't know, because the guy's incredible. He seems just awesome. But basically what Project Tango is this is so cool. They're basically taking a 5-inch smartphone, and they packed 4 cameras into it. And 2 of them are wide-angle cameras, one's like an 8-megapixel camera, and one's a depth sensor camera. And effectively what this thing does is you hold it up, and you can pan around your room, and it's got all sorts of sensors in it, accelerometers, and gyroscopes and whatnot. So it kind of knows where it is, and GPS. It's got all what your smartphones have. And it's doing all the depth sensor stuff, and so it creates a map of whatever you're looking at, cool, of all the depths of it. And because it's got a camera built into it, it's also taking that depth map and putting the camera textures over it, and you can build 3D environments really super quickly with this camera, just walking around your house. And I want one so bad I can't even stand it. They were giving away 200 dev kits, and
I missed it.
I know. I tried to talk myself into signing up for it, but A, they gave them away the day that I realized that you could sign up for it, and B, I was like, oh yeah, that's right, I am woefully underprepared to do something like that. Like, I'm not that good of a programmer. But they're like, they were showing videos of like, it has a depth map of what's going on. So they're like showing stuff where like, you could play video games where like the example I'm going to give, very topical. It's going to be like, you're in your room and you have like a little crosshair on your screen and you look around your room looking for invisible leprechauns that your screen can show you. And you can like shoot at the leprechauns and the leprechauns are jumping around because you've got a 3D and it's sensing the 3D environment. And so you can, digital things can interact with the 3D environment through the screen, right? And it's just really cool. It's really awesome. And I had this idea, and this is what I want to do. And it's not quite there yet, but soon and very soon it will be. So I'm going to share with you, this is where I want to go with it, okay? I want to take a Tango or an equivalent product. I want to strap it to the front of my Oculus Rift. Now, probably the best way to do this is going to be like to actually build it into it. But this is what I want. Is I want a thing that's doing 3D depth maps of my room and then transmitting the image into the screen on my Oculus Rift. So I have this like, you're like, why would you do that? You basically just built a 3D fully immersive, you know, your universe. Why don't you just take it off your head so you can see it? But wait, there's more.
That's okay. Boring.
I know. So this is what you would do, okay?
Okay.
You'd walk into your room and you'd sit down and you'd look at the floor and you'd take kind of a map of your room and then what you do is you take your pile of Legos and you pour your Legos out onto the floor. And I would be doing the same thing in my room, right? And so then we'd build our little Lego army. We'd build tanks, and we'd build robots, and we'd build all our minifigures, and we'd put them all together, okay? And after the clock runs out, because you've only got 5 minutes to do this, after the clock runs out, what we're going to do is all of them are going to be digitally deleted because you've already got, you know what the textures behind the pile of Legos are supposed to be. This way you accidentally walk on them. And then they reappear, but now they're controllable, you know, models that you've built. And so now you can start commanding them, like, I want these Legos to go march into the hallway. I want these Legos to protect the castle. I want these Legos to get into their planes. And so things start taking off, and all of a sudden, in your actual environment, based off of Legos you've actually built, you can have a dual battle with your brother.
Ha!
And I'm guessing 5 years. 5 years we're going to be having full-on Lego wars.
I'm pretty certain it won't actually be a war. It'll just be a whipping.
Wow. You're right, James. I appreciate your confidence in my abilities. I would crush you. Actually, dude.
Not exactly.
I'm gonna say,
not exactly.
I remember us doing that as kids, and it drove me nuts. Because, like, I think it was Brian Nelson or Timmy or somebody. It was one of my friends. It wasn't yours, but it was, like, the three of us. And we were going to build our armies, and we, like, were on our separate rooms, and, like, we built, like, two or three, like, these really complicated, cool planes with wings and propellers and stuff. And you were in your room, and your planes consisted of four bricks and one Lego head. So you had an army of 7,000 little dinky nothings, and we had our planes, and you're like, sure, you can take out 20 of my planes with one of yours, but I've got, you know, 27-1, so I will win this war. What the heck? I was... Oh, it drove me nuts as a kid. I still remember.
Yeah, that's right. That's how I still play. Brute force attack. It's my funny. Style.
Original Command & Conquer, was so classic. You loved Nod because, you know, you could just build these giant armies of quick, mobile, light infantry. Yep. And I loved GDI because I could build large tanks that move slowly and were basically invincible. But yeah, that's the future. That's where we're going, by the way. I guess that was my point. It's a cool project. I want one. I don't have an excuse to get one, but definitely.
My imagination on that is so woefully inadequate, because my first thought was like, oh, cool, virtual tours.
Yeah.
Help me sell. Yeah. Help me rent out a home. I love it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not saying you can't do that.
I know. I'm just, like I said, that's like, and then I stopped. There's probably other stuff you could do with it, but why?
Exactly.
Actually, here's one. So I was FaceTiming with our parents who were totally at home right now. And no, they're not. They're visiting our sister. Don't go rob them. You don't know where they live.
I'm gonna say. Especially since I'm going to be spending a lot of time there, so please don't go rob them.
There you go.
I'll have to fight you.
Yeah, but anyways, they were... my mom's totally going to listen to this later. It's going to be great.
I know.
that's part of what makes it fun. they're at Disney World right now visiting our sister. And so I FaceTimed with her this morning, and they were in the middle of the Hollywood tour. And I was like, dude, turn your camera around. I know what your face looks like. What are you touring right now? And so for part of it, they were going through the wardrobe part, and they were looking at the airplanes, and I was sitting there watching it with them and just talking with them, and the microphone guy was loud enough that I could hear very clearly what he was saying. And we hung out for like 10 minutes while I was on the tour with them, essentially.
That's cool.
And so... Yeah, and I mean, there's a part of me that's like, dude, technology is pretty awesome.
To be able to technology. Like that.
It's true. But imagine how this could take that to the next level, where, you know, like you're talking about, she could be filming it like she was, and now what I'm seeing in, you know, could be real time, you know, isn't just this flat static image. Maybe I am wearing an Oculus Rift, or, you know, I'm talking to her using some headset, and I feel like I'm there with her.
Right.
And, you know, and that could bring, I'm even thinking, like, what if you do, you know, you have virtual meetings now where, you know, what we're doing right now, imagine, do you take that to the next step where, you know, it actually feels like I'm sitting there in the room with you.
Yeah.
And you know, so I could definitely see... Those are legitimate use cases, and I could clearly see companies want to invest in that, and that would have value to bring virtual teams closer together, and to allow for pictures and video to be that much more immersive. Imagine that they somehow get this onto YouTube, and record your video, do whatever, and then when someone watches it, it's a truly 3D immersive video now.
Right.
So I could see a lot of cool stuff. That's a very cool technology, and I could see a lot of uses for it, for sure. Tango, huh?
Yeah.
That's within the Google unit?
Yep. Get Google it.
Godrel. All right. Sweet. What?
Godrel. I like it. You're going to Godrel it.
Yeah. That's my fallback.
Godrel.
Yeah. Cool. Hey, that's neat. That's neat. Mm-hmm.
I like it.
That was a different show than normal, I think. Yeah. Yet also oddly familiar.
Mm-hmm. It's good. I like it.
What was that? That's from Sergeant Bilko, right?
That's right. Oh my god.
So if you've never seen the movie Sergeant Bilko, highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. Has Steve Martin. He's hilarious. There's a scene where they're going through this guy. He's in the military, and through a set of circumstances, they're pretending that their barracks are someone else's barracks, or. There, yeah, they're pretending that someone else's barracks is theirs, and so this guy, he's standing, white dude, standing in this room, and there's a picture of an African-American family, and he's like, what's this?
Yeah.
And he goes, oh, those are the stars of my favorite sitcom, it's All in the Family, or something like that. He goes, it's pretty funny, but it also makes you think.
It's
all
funny.
Right.
It also makes you think.
just a classic line. Oh, that's a great movie. Oh, I want to go watch that again.
I
own that one. I could actually do it. I wouldn't have to watch it on VH1 or anything.
I know, right?
Cool. That is what you call a callback. at the end of a show, you call back an earlier reference. For those of you who are interested in comedians do it all the time, it works really well. Yeah. Cool, man. Cool. It's a good show. Good show.
Yeah, definitely.
Let's see here.
Well done.
Close this thing. Yeah. So, everybody, thank you for joining us. I am James Furlow. My brother is Matthew Furlow, and we will talk next time. Awesome sauce!